The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Nightclub at the end of the world. Hi, everybody. It's Michael Rupert again. I'm back. It is October 30th, 2011, day before Halloween. When in the spirit world, the veil is supposed to be the thinnest between the spirit world and the physical world. Well, it sure looks to me like there's a whole bunch of monsters and goblins running around right now. They all seem to be in business suits or as politicians, but they're doing a good job of scaring me. Charles Eisenstein is back with us tonight. Before I bring Charles on, I just want to update you a little bit. We had a monumental day yesterday at Occupy Santa Rosa, and I want to talk about that because it was a very powerful experience. I have to tell you first that this week, as I watched the brutality in Oakland, and I was sitting at the screen, I was just sitting here crying like a baby. I was so ashamed to see police officers behaving that way, that brutally, and it was shocking, and it stirred a great many people, and that motivated me to make a tape, which I did, to all police officers, speaking about this issue about honor, which Marine Sergeant Shamar Thomas so eloquently stated in Times Square when he confronted 30 looking for a fight New York PD cops. Unarmed civilians don't want to fight, but a line was drawn in the sand around Santa Rosa. The story had surfaced that, and it proved to be, I believe, untrue now, but there were reports that a contingent from Santa Rosa PD had gone to Oakland, which we didn't find out until yesterday, apparently was not true. But the city of Santa Rosa had issued a statement saying that they would use whatever force necessary to remove Occupy Santa Rosa protesters if they erected tents on the city hall by 10 p.m. last night. And I put out a call, a great many people put out a call, but apparently that, you know, it wasn't necessary because there were a great many honorable warriors who were just sickened by what they had seen in Oakland. And we had a huge contingent of veterans at Santa Rosa yesterday. We had guys from the 101st, guys from the 173rd Airborne Brigade, the 3rd Herd of the 82nd. We had Marines, we had sailors, then there was an awesome Special Forces medic, I'll call him Kay, who is a permanent fixture at the camp. He's the medic in security there. There were Navy vets, there were all kinds of people there, and it's really funny that We were all concerned that this was going to be a violent showdown in Santa Rosa following up on Oakland. And apparently all of us came to the same conclusion in our own ways. But we arrived with a uniform standard sentiment. I went up to the former Special Forces guy. He was an Afghan veteran who'd been shot through both knees and had knee replacements. He's out, but he moves around like a Special Forces guy beautifully and well in control. And I walked up to him and we were talking, and I said, "Look, if there is an attack on the people here, I intend to put my body in between." He said, "You don't have to say it. We're all at the same page." And over the course of the next 5-10 minutes before the march started at about 2 o'clock, 2:30. I met all these vets, and everybody had come with the same mind that there was an oath taken by military veterans and those of us to protect the innocent people, but also to protect this country and this Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And there was a big impression. And just before the march started, at 2:30, the tension was building. I was the last speaker before the march. I was the speaker that launched the march, and I was all geared up to lay it out on the line. And a letter was read from the podium, and the city manager Kathy Millison wrote a good letter, issuing a complete stand down to all police, allowing the tents to be erected, giving us freedom to move in the middle of the street through intersections on a march with We had about 600 people in the march, and it was a cave-in, and it was wonderful, and it was beautiful, and we felt a real sense of power. So there, 35 tents are up there now, and I took a tent, but it got thrown into the community pile, so I wound up sleeping outside in a sleeping bag. It was about 39 degrees. That's nothing compared to what people in New York and New England are facing tonight, but it's been a pretty good weekend for the Occupy movement. Some arrests, some rubber bullets fired, I think, in Denver, Nashville, Texas. There have been problems, but the movement continues to grow. It continues to find power and a voice, and until you've had the experience of actually living for 24 hours or moving in to one of these Occupy settlements, you won't understand the magic that has taken place there, especially with the way things get done almost magically now. And so I'm just extremely gratified. I'm very tired, very glad to be back, and I'm very much looking forward to our guest tonight. We just didn't have enough time to talk, and hopefully we'll have some more time to really focus on some themes that come up. Around the world, the economic situation is just, it is debaculous. That's a word I made up here, I think, on this show. And it gets more debaculous by the minute. The European bailout that they were celebrating last week, the story's coming out on the World News Desk tomorrow at CollapseNet, say that this solution has 2 weeks at most. So we don't know who's kidding who, but everything continues to deteriorate. But what I'm so happy about now is to experience this change of consciousness that is happening, again, much, much faster than I had suspected it could. I mean, it may be possible that we can find our 100th monkey, find a new state of human consciousness before everything is destroyed, and that's what we're hoping for. And one of the things that we want to talk about, of course, is my one of my trademark lines is, until you change the way money works, you change nothing. And so that's the fundamental problem. And there were a lot of hip people there. There were no Alex Jones people out there. There were, people got it. And when I gave my speech right before the march, I said, our jobs have been stolen, our homes have been stolen, our pensions have been stolen, our future has been stolen, our country has been stolen, and our planet has been stolen. And you should have heard the cheers. Of course, that didn't make any of the news coverage. They can't see me, which is absolutely fine. I'm happy to be like the wind as long as I can see the leaves blowing in the trees when I make a move. When we make a move, when our consciousness makes a move, there's a lot of people out there paying attention to us. And what I said, too, I also addressed all police everywhere in the world. And I basically said that, this is the collapse of human industrial civilization. Over the course of the last year or so, we've seen hundreds and hundreds of thousands of police officers worldwide laid off due to budget cuts and austerity. That's not getting any better, and the system will work to make sure that only the most bloodthirsty keep their jobs. And you could see that there was, not only there in Santa Rosa, but you can feel it around the country now. There's a lot of police officers doing a lot of soul searching, and we hope for the moment when we find a 100th monkey and maybe he's a cop somewhere. Because when the cops stop enforcing, when all of the people that make the system work refuse to participate, that's when we've won hands down. So we're going to go back tonight to talking about the changes that need to be made and maybe looking at some of the really interesting and bizarre things that are happening with money right now. Charles Eisenstein, one of my favorite writers, I mean, and he's really captivated a lot of people. He's 44. He's a graduate of Yale. He's a writer. Yeah, he's an essayist. He's got two books, The Ascent of Man, which I haven't read. It's a large tome, which took Charles 4 years to write. I think it came out in 2007. But I have read his latest book, Sacred Economics, which came out in 2010. And it's just so brilliant. It so captures so many insights and so many understandings about the interrelationship between money and spirit, or if you will, religious power in this, not only the symbology, but the constructs that are used and the way it works on us. And he's just a steak dinner for me to read. Charles is now on the faculty of Goddard College, and he continues to write and he speaks and publish on this most important topic. I think he's just spoken at Occupy Wall Street in New York. We're going to ask him in a minute. But it's really good to have you back on the show, Charles. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
All right.
Great to be back.
Did you go speak at OWS?
I was there in New York, yeah.
How'd it go?
And it was very moving. And I was in Philadelphia also the week before at Occupy Philly.
Mm-hmm.
And I really resonate with your story. I'm really happy that things turned out that way. And,
oh, yeah.
And I just think it's so important to give the message you're giving to police officers, you know, because what I noticed at Occupy Wall Street was most of them underneath like a very stern exterior, like some of them were trying, like they're moved too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think many of them have this kind of inner conflict where part of them has been trained and conditioned and brainwashed even to, you know, being in authority and suppressing any dissent just because it's dissent and so forth. And then another part of them really wants to do the right thing. And that part of them is getting evoked right now. And I think it's really important to speak to that, you know, and to speak to that sense of honor and the desire to protect the weak and the desire to be the good policeman who, you know, helps people out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think even in the bloodthirsty ones, there's probably even like a tiny speck of that, you know?
Yes.
And when you speak to that, like, you almost can speak it into existence. When you look at somebody and you say, I know you want to do the right thing, then they know it too. And so I think your work is so important. And anyway, I'm just really honored to be here again.
Well, thank you. It's kind of a good theme that came up because I was listening to Gary Null before this show came on, and Gary was speaking very eloquently about how the system builds up institutional truths and things that, you know, things that you can't question, you can't challenge, and everything else. Mm-hmm. And I will speak to this because police officers are a breed that, you know, you get very concerned and you are put into this class that you're kind of special because you know your paychecks are always going to be good. You know, you're pretty much going to be taken care of, but you focus on your pension, you focus on, you know, your scale of promotion, your seniority pay and all that. And to think about giving that up, and that's been woven in, unfortunately, by the way money works, into how police officers tend to identify themselves. It's not just the badge and the gun, it's the pension, it's the medical benefits, it's the, you know, it's the perks and the prerogatives. But that's one of the hardest things to go through. I know that when I was getting ready to resign from LAPD back in November 1978, mm-hmm. there was a long period, about 6-8 months, where it was like cutting my own body apart. But this gets easier now because the choices are becoming starker. When I don't think there's any policeman anywhere in this country who could watch the video of what happened in Oakland, California, and say, "Oorah!"
Yep.
It was shameful. It was disgusting. I did receive unconfirmed reports last night that came back through the movement, because I've been offline for a couple days, that police in Cleveland, I believe it was, were actually going to the Occupy sites and handing out blankets and sleeping bags.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the kind of magic we need to see. But how do we do that with money? That's the big problem with us. That's the big issue.
Yeah. You know, you talked about a shift of consciousness, and one way I describe the changes that are necessary and that will happen in the money system is that the money system we have today is built on an old consciousness that, you know, I call it separation, the idea that we're all separate beings in an external universe and that, you know, we're all in competition with each other. Biologists say that, you know, all organisms are driven by their genes to maximize reproductive self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
Economists say pretty much the same thing. You know, we're these separate beings. And so we have a money system that necessitates separation and that also propels the endless growth of the human realm and you know, treats nature as something to be conquered. But people don't actually resonate with that anymore.
No.
Our consciousness has moved. You know, today we are understanding our oneness with each other. That doesn't sound too much like a New Age cliche, but it's true. And we're desiring no longer to conquer nature, but to heal nature, and to, you know, we're recognizing our dependency on nature.
I heard the best line yesterday. You're going to love this. You're absolutely going to love this. you know how guys like you and me, we agonize for months to write, you know, a chapter or a paragraph to, you know, to put some great truths on paper. And then all of a sudden, you're walking around like a year, 2 years later, and you hear somebody that says everything in all in one sentence that we have labored, like, you know, years to write. So I'm at Occupy Santa Rosa last night, and this young woman walks by, and she looks at me, and she says, "All right, if we have dominion over this planet, how come we're the only species who has to pay to live here?"
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
That pretty much says it all, you know.
There's something.
But yeah, so we have, you know, we have a money system that is built on an old consciousness, and the consciousness has shifted. And so that's what I write about. You know, what would money look like if it were based on the consciousness of non-separation, of the desire to heal nature, to co-create with nature, to serve other people, all the stuff that, you know, 100 years ago, people didn't think like that. People glorified the conquest of nature. But I think that the shift of consciousness is already underway, and the institutions will follow. The ground has shifted underneath the institutions, not just money, but you know, everything else. I mean, even the military, even the medical system, the educational system. Every single one of them is approaching a state of crisis.
It was just so amazing to see the vets there yesterday. I mean,
yeah,
from
so
Vietnam,
you know,
all the way through current conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about clear-eyed, straight-headed people. They said, "This is wrong. We're gonna, you know," and it was so clear that not a one of them. I'll count myself as an LAPD vet because we were all together. You know, not a one of us would have hesitated for a second to put our body in front of a bullet or a nightstick or a flashbang or whatever was going to happen.
Yeah,
because that just has to do with who we are, and that's really encouraging. Now, I see these changes happening, and here's where I'm being shown that the construct I've worked with for many years needs to change, because I have always operated under the assumption, based upon all of my research, you know, for all these decades, that this old paradigm was not going to let go until it had destroyed everything. And now I'm beginning to think that might not be the way it has to play. The change of consciousness is happening that fast. So the question is now, from a governmental, for lack of a better word, standpoint, and this is where I really want to pick your brain, how do we step by step first dismantle infinite growth? That's, you know, that's what I've said clearly, fractional reserve banking, et cetera, et cetera. But then how do we shift the weight functionally to keep things going so that people can eat and some things can run in the process? And that's where I really want to just sit back and listen to you.
Okay. Which one should we start with here?
Take anything you want, man.
Well, you know, a lot of the things that people are doing today that they've been doing with a sense of futility and despair for a long time, but you know, persevering, you know, fighting the new roads, you know, trying to save the rainforests, trying to save the whales, trying to save, prevent indigenous tribes from being overrun, you know, trying to reform the prison system. I mean, all of this work that you know, there's isolated battles amidst a tide of defeat. All that work is really important, because one way I describe the money system is that it turns nature into goods and relationships into services. And I mean, that's what economic growth is, essentially. You pay for things that were once like childcare or food preparation, or going back a number of generations, medicine, you know, that used to be the village herbalist, you know, or entertainment. You know, we used to sing songs for each other. And all of these things have been converted into goods and services, what was once free. And the money system depends on that, and when growth slows down, the money system goes into crisis really quickly. So if you want to shorten the lifespan of the money system, you can deprive it of food. If anything that you make off limits to being converted into money, for example, if you stop fracking from happening somewhere, you know, that's a certain amount of natural gas and clean water that doesn't get converted into money. If you make some land off limits to development, that's another piece of nature that doesn't get converted into money.
Mm-hmm.
So you're depriving the machine of food and hastening its demise. And at the same time, you're preserving some wealth from which we can rebuild.
Yes.
After the collapse happens.
Yes.
And this, so, you know, all of these invisible things or all of these isolated victories and this shift of consciousness that is refusing to be commodified, that's what we're going to rebuild from. So a lot of the things that people are doing already are really important. And then, of course, there's building the models for how society can work. And I'm seeing a lot of that at Occupy Wall Street, too.
Oh, yeah. Tell me, I was walking through the camp, and no money was exchanging hands anywhere. No, not mm-hmm. what we call money. There was food, there was water, you could get tea and mm-hmm. and stuff was just happening. And I shared this experience with everybody there, including some of the long-term occupiers. And they were all just smiling because they said, we're all just watching how this, we don't know how this is happening, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And let me just stop right now, if I could, on behalf of the Occupy movement worldwide, if you would like to support, first of all, just go to one of these places, walk around and talk to people. It's amazing. But better yet, have the experience of sleeping out overnight there. But they run by donations, so they always need water. They always need food. They'll be needing, blankets and cold weather gear as the winter comes up. But go by and ask what they need and take it to them. And take it to them preferably from your own backyard or someplace that's local. Because the movement is being supported worldwide by many, many people who are just showing up and saying, hey, here's 3 crates of apples. Here's, here's 10 loaves of bread. And all the camps are thriving. And anyway, I'm sorry, I just wanted to say that, but anybody who wants to help, you need to have this experience yourself to see it. Go ahead, Charles, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's really relevant. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And when you're there, you get a sense, you could say that gift economy is subsidized through the outside commodity economy, but when you're there, you get a sense that this is how human beings are supposed to live.
Yes.
It's not some, little fantasy world. Many people get that sense when they go to Burning Man or some of these other gift culture places too. And also, when a big disaster hits, even here in Harrisburg, we had floods last month. The Susquehanna River rose like 30 feet,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people were flooded out of their homes. And as soon as that happened, everyone started helping each other.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened after 9/11.
We're coming up on time for a song before we go to station break. I'm going to pose this question. We'll pick this up after the bottom of the hour. I have this nightmare, Charles, where somebody comes and says, okay, you're king, you're president, you're dictator, mm-hmm. you're in charge. What would you do? And I'm, oh, my God, well, here's what I've boiled it down to, and we'll pick this up after we do the song and come back, is how do we keep trucks flowing with food, food being processed, food being shipped to stores, essential goods and services moving without money. And I wound up in the dream just phrasing it as, that's what you do. Don't worry about money, just keep doing what you do. But obviously there's more mechanics in that. The song we're going to play tonight from New White Trash, I think you'll like this, Charles, is one of the songs I wrote. I sing the lead on it. It's called Weird Kind of Sense. And it was a song that I wrote very much in mind. With it in mind about what I would want to say to the generation that we're leaving all this crap to, but hopefully we're going to leave them something bright. But it's called Weird Kind of Sense. We'll be right back in a minute.
Oh, what a mess we left you. Oh, what a mess we left you. Against the odds of the gods, we left you such a mess.
Posting on tea and champagne. Left but a dry dismay, camped by the fire in full moonlight, under the change of a changing world of vain. Oh, what a mess we left you. Oh, what a mess we left you. This is not tomorrow.
There is no tomorrow.
pretend today is not a drill.
That's a weird kind of sense.
Yesterday needs no warning, and the prophecies fulfilled.
What a mess we left in.
That didn't make the final cut, but if I ever get the chance to do my song live, I'm going to put it back in there. It's a refrain that goes, "We looked into the fire, and the fire looked back."
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird kind of sense of New White Trash, newwhitetrash.com. We're coming up on the station break with Charles Eisenstein, our guest tonight. I do have a couple of emails that have come in. I'm going to spend a lot of time talking with Charles before we go to calls or emails tonight. There's just some really important stuff I want to hear from this great guest. You can email me at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. And if you do want to call, wait until at least a quarter of the hour, because we're going to spend time with Charles right after we come back from the station break, which is right now. Say a prayer for the new white trash. Yeah, that's us. That's back. NewWhiteTrash.com. Go check us out. Some good tunes there. I got it to sing a lot last night at the campsite, like you were talking, Charles. And there was an acoustic guitar, and we did it, and I was just really hoarse from the march, and I wound up singing really good. And we had some fun there, but it was so much better live in person, with music being the spiritual gift that it's supposed to be, free from money, and just to lift people's hearts. So anyway, right before the station break, I threw out this huge $64,000 question. We're in charge, Charles, as of tomorrow.
Yeah.
And infinite growth doesn't exist. The banks don't circulate. There's no loans. There's no compound interest. How do we keep things running?
All right. This is a great question. I'm gonna just set a little background, which is the myth of scarcity. Do you know, Michael, do you know what the largest cultivated crop in America is in terms of land area?
Corn, probably, I would think.
No, it's lawn grass.
Ah, of course.
Lawn grass, and it's also the biggest user of pesticides.
And it's also put onto soil that's been really polluted with chemicals that's not very healthy by itself. But go ahead.
Right, and another thing to realize is that organic agriculture, according to the Rodale Institute, which has done studies on it, is 2 to 3 times more productive than conventional agriculture per land area, not per labor unit. So if we had an organic agricultural system nationwide, we'd have, instead of 2% of the people working on farms, it might be 10 or 15% of the people, and everybody would have a garden. All right, so this, and I want to say also energy as well. If we spent the amount of resources and scientific brilliance and human labor to develop clean, abundant energy resources that we spend today on weaponry and things like that,
right,
we'd also have no shortage of energy either, not even going to some of these more out there energy technologies.
All right, let me ask you a question there. When you say no shortage of energy, we have now 1 billion internal combustion-powered vehicles on the planet. How do we keep those running?
Well, we would not be able to keep all of them running.
Yes.
Yeah. But to get to the meat of the question, though, so I'm president or dictator here. Well, the first thing I would do is to bail out all of the banks, but to do it with negative interest currency that and monetize, essentially monetize all debt. Buy all of the student loans and forgive them.
Mm-hmm.
Buy all of the, maybe even buy all the mortgages and forgive them.
Mm, I would have a problem with the fraudulent ones. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, because there is, you don't want the money system to completely collapse.
Right.
Because that wipes everybody's savings, too.
Right.
Right. But it's horrible to you know, bail out the bad loans and the risky derivatives and all that kind of stuff, and with an asset money that enables them to continue enriching themselves. So one of the main themes of the book is negative interest currency, which in its modern incarnation means that deposits in the Federal Reserve or central bank. But you could use it without a Federal Reserve also, but these have a negative interest rate of maybe 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So if you keep the money, you get poorer and poorer. It loses its value, which makes money like everything else in the universe. It returns to its source. It decays.
Yes.
And so you can no longer have an advantage from the possession of money, but you would even have an incentive to lend it out at zero interest. So it kind of reverses the dynamics of interest today, which causes the concentration of wealth. And this is one piece that's really important, because so much of what money does today is because it's created as interest-bearing debt.
Mm-hmm.
If it were created as negative interest-bearing debt, then it would have an opposite effect. It would push toward egalitarianism. It would reverse the discounting of future cash flows.
Right.
Which says, you know, it's better to clear-cut a forest now for $100 million than it is to log it sustainably for $1 million a year forever, because the interest on $100 million is more than $1 million a year.
There you go.
And that's what we're doing to the planet.
All right, now,
and
well,
I'm not going to go into all the details there.
Okay.
But one thing that I've learned as I wrote this book, you know, I expected at the beginning that nothing less than a wholesale revolution, a sweeping aside of the old, and a building something completely new from scratch would suffice. But what I came to realize is that the transition can be a lot gentler than I thought.
Yeah.
And so that's one piece, a very practical piece. Another piece is that we have to internalize costs that are now externalized onto the environment and onto society and onto future generations, like pollution, for example, or depletion of aquifers. You know, you should have to. Anything that you take from everybody, you should have to pay for. You shouldn't be able to just to profit off everybody else's loss
mm-hmm.
when you're making pollution or using something up that should belong to the whole earth and all its beings. Another piece is a social dividend, like they have in Alaska,
mm-hmm.
where every citizen gets an annual check as their share of the oil wealth. Well, we should all get an annual check as our share of all of the riches of the earth and all of our cultural heritage of technology and invention.
All right, let me ask a technical question. Let's say I'm a banker, and you come in and you want to borrow $10,000. Negative interest mm-hmm. says you're only paying me back $9,500. How do I make money on that?
Well,
the banker, you're
the banker, you might lend it to me at zero interest.
Okay.
But people are making deposits to you at a negative interest rate.
Right.
Right. So, and because cash would decay at, say, you know, negative 5%. So, you know, you might be able to put it in a bank account at negative 4% or negative 3%, and then it could be lent out at 0%.
That would really encourage spending, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you would, if you had something you wanted to spend to buy, then you would want to buy it right away before your money declined in value.
So what does that do to the concept of savings?
Well, you could still have savings. The best way to have savings would be to lend the money at zero interest to somebody who would give it back to you when you needed it.
Now here's where the spiritual side of this is so important, because what you build in a gift economy, or when you lend at zero interest, is you build what Dmitry Orlov might call blot. You know, you build a social capital.
Right.
Which is, and that's what I see being exchanged at the Occupy settlements. Okay.
Yeah, that's how savings worked in ancient gift societies. You know, when you were in the productive prime of your life, you gave many gifts to many people.
Mm-hmm.
You were maybe a great hunter, say, and every time you killed a large game, you would have a huge feast and invite everybody from miles around.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you were good at, you would use that as a source of gifts, because in those cultures, you never kept more than you needed. That would be stupid to keep it all yourself and let it go bad, let it get eaten by dogs, you know, let it decay. You would rather circulate it and have everybody kind of owe you one, generate gratitude in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And what negative interest economics does is it kind of maps that spirit and those logistics onto money. So again, like, you don't gain benefit from just keeping it, you have to circulate it. And so today, in our interest-based economy, banks aren't lending, because they'll only lend to you if you're going to give them even more back.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll only happen if you can produce more goods and services. So it forces growth. But if the money were lent at zero interest or negative interest, then money could flow without the economy having to keep growing. And that's okay. That's the key to that idea.
Okay, so I'm running a major Western regional food distribution company.
Mm-hmm.
And I rely on credit lines from the bank. I have floats on my receivables, all the stuff that they
right.
do out there.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden this ends, and I'm sitting here going, okay, well, now I'm supposed to pick up food from, God forbid, Cargill or whatever. I'm just thinking how the mainstream works. And
yeah.
But we're not doing money, and I've got to put diesel in my trucks, and then so...
Yeah,
that's where I see people kind of grind to a halt, because they have no concept
right.
of how that would work. So let's say we're posed with that situation. What do we tell people?
Yeah, well, we don't want that to happen. So
no.
why should we let that happen?
Right.
I think maybe in hundreds of years we'll have a society where we don't have money, or where money is so different from what it is today that we would no longer call it money. But in the near future, you know, I'm in favor of as gentle a transition as we can achieve.
Yes.
So it's not a matter of abolishing money or even letting it completely disappear to hyperinflation or something, but it's a matter of changing its nature so that it aligns with our shift of consciousness and
mm-hmm.
aligns with what we want to create and hold valuable on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can align money with ecological restoration, because money is just an agreement. We can
yeah.
we can make it reflect whatever values we hold. Up until now, it's unconsciously reflected the value of growth.
Right.
And it works fine in a high growth economy. But we can make it reflect other values.
I saw the most amazing story, which is going to be on our world news desk tomorrow at CollapseNet. It's from Société Générale. And they just released a report, and I was just skimming it before the show. That declares that all world economies are now mature economies,
mm-hmm.
that all world economies are now past the point of growth. Flatly just saying that there are limits to growth, and we've reached
mm-hmm.
them. From Société Générale, they've actually been pretty decent, I think, over the last few years in some of their assessments.
Mm.
But it's amazing to see that this change of consciousness is really taking place on a great many levels all at once. Again, being the skeptic that I am from the background that I have, you know, with the spies and the lies and the drugs
right.
and the spooks and the guns and all that stuff, is that I'm very skeptical that the powers that be are going to let go of their control. But what I'm seeing with Occupy Wall Street is we might just be able to walk around them.
Yeah, and I think part of it is that the powers that be, at least a large portion of them, their hearts really aren't in it either, in keeping control.
Talk more
trapped.
About that.
They're trapped by organizations and trapped by ideologies that compel them to continue playing the roles that they play, but their hearts aren't in it anymore.
That's what Gary Null was, I think, talking around the last show. Okay, more, go ahead.
Well, I mean, you have whole organizations, corporations, doing things that not a single person in the corporation approves of.
Mm-hmm.
But they're afraid to step out, just like the police officers you're talking about are
exactly.
afraid to step out of their benefits and their whole police culture, you know, and So these people are afraid to step out too, but they want to step out, and they have to be. We have to give them kind of permission to do that, make them feel that it's safe to do that, or they're allowed to do that, which kind of happened in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where at the beginning, the power elite of the country was unified in their stand against dissent. We will not tolerate dissent. We will crack down. But then when things progressed to a certain point, a portion of the elite defected to the protesters. And a cynic might say that they saw the writing on the wall and wanted to join the winning side. But I think that probably part of them actually wanted to do that, sympathized with the protesters, and had progressed in their consciousness to a point where, you know, I just don't want to shoot at people.
Exactly.
And so then the protests, you know, gave them the courage to do what they really wanted to do in their hearts to begin with.
That's still what we saw yesterday at Santa Rosa with all these veterans. Veterans for Peace was out. We had, you know, 12, 14 veterans very prominently displayed throughout the crowd, very, very clear on where we were. And that's exactly what I felt we were doing, is we were showing these guys, or reminding them perhaps, what it was like and what it was they donned the uniform and the badge first time.
Beautiful.
To begin with, we have a caller with a question. We have a quarter of an hour to go. We have to do like a multi-hour show, Charles. I don't know how we do it. Maybe we have you back regularly. But Matt in Wisconsin's on the line. He's got a question about Greek debt. Matt, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Fire away, buddy.
First off, I just want to say thank you for what you guys do. It's a beautiful thing. My question is, what would you say is the general time frame for when, if we agree that Greece falling would be the first domino, what would you say the general time frame would be for the unraveling of industrial civilization? How long after that would it be very obvious to everyone?
Well,
I know that's a very difficult question. You probably don't have an exact answer, but kind of just a general.
My view of that is that it's kind of like a rope that's being pulled tauter and tauter, and as it gets pulled tauter, it takes less and less to make it snap. But it could snap at any time. It depends on how, I mean, there could be a huge natural disaster, some geopolitical thing that spirals out of control, and that provides the nick to the rope that makes it snap. Or things could you know, keep going on for quite a while. It's really hard to predict, but I want to say that I don't think that it's the unraveling of industrial society as much as a radical transformation of industrial society.
Yeah. From a technical side, the story's coming out on the World News Desk at Kolesnik tomorrow. The current latest proposed magical mystery solution to the European crisis is already being given 2 weeks or less before that's shown to be a complete fraud. When Greece goes at a 50% haircut, that is a default, and it will be ruled as such. And what I look at is that when there is a default, it is a default not just to Greece or to Europe that will fall sequentially. It is a default which is a pin in the side of a $1.4 quadrillion derivatives bubble, which is imploding already anywhere anyway because nobody is growing anymore. We will not have to witness a sequential fall of every domino. There's going to be one domino here, and I kind of think it's going to be Greece. That punctures the bubble for everything because nobody is lending any money. China's backing out from bailing out Europe. Brazil and India. India is collapsing as we speak, and yet they're still touting that India is going to buy. And not true. India is suffering major blackouts in major cities lasting for 4 or 5 days at a time, shutting down industrial production. So there's, you know, and there's a great new video out from the cartoon people who used to do the bears, explaining the European bailout, and it's absolutely hilarious. And at the conclusion was that they were going to get aliens to lend the money. Well, that's not going to work. So that's where I am with that. I got a couple more emails. There's a couple of really good questions, Charles, I'd like to get in. Thank you, Matt, for calling. I appreciate
it. Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
All right, man. Josh Stern, who's a regular listener, wrote a couple of good questions. Mike, since you guys are talking economics, I have a few questions. I find it so incredibly obvious that oil is the lifeblood of the world economy, yet economists keep on talking about symptoms of the economic problems we are facing, debt, unemployment, etc., instead of talking about the production of oil. Are economists completely oblivious, or do they know and they don't want to stir the markets? You get the question, Charles. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I think that peak oil, the idea of peak oil, is it's tapping into an important principle that I call peak everything.
Mm-hmm.
We could continue to increase the production of oil for a long time. It depends on how much of a price we want to pay. Like, for example, with the Alberta tar sands. I mean, the ecological damage to that or to deep water oil drilling and stuff is just tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
So by keeping oil production increasing, we are accelerating our approach to peak environmental capacity for our destruction.
Yes.
And that's the biggest peak of all.
Colin,
so you can shift economic growth from one thing to another. Instead of monetizing oil, you can monetize community or monetize people's kidneys or something. I mean, there's lots of ways to shift economic growth. It's just like the way they shift the debts around.
Right.
But you can't get around peak everything.
Colin Campbell said it beautifully. He said, the moment it costs more money to get a barrel of oil out of the ground than you get for selling it, oil production ceases. So it's tied back into that mystery voodoo infinite growth, monetary nonsense.
Yeah.
But and one of the things Campbell said, has always said so very clearly for all the years that I've known him, was that what you have to do is conserve the resource now while you can. And that's why I just shudder when I see all that oil being wasted on 2012 and 2013 infinity blah blahs, you know.
Especially because most of the oil doesn't even go toward anything that furthers human happiness, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All it does is serve the money beast. Josh wrote another question, then we'll come back for the last 10 minutes. I also wanted to ask if you can explain the 50% haircut with debt leverage up to 60 to 1. How can Europe survive with a haircut of that size, even to Greece? That was exactly my point, Josh, in answering the question before. None of the debt that has already been printed, let alone what they are proposing to print, can physically be repaid by the planet. That simple. Charles, we got about 10 minutes left, so we've probably done the same thing we did last week. We touched on two or three different things that were very important, and we didn't get a chance to follow up, but please go wherever you want to go for the last 10 minutes, bud.
Well, this has been great this time. Where do I want to go with it? Let me see. Where was I before?
We were trying to get food into people's bellies after we've taken over the planet.
Right. I want to say that the kind of transformation of money that I'm talking about, and it's not just me, actually. There have even been some pretty prominent economists who have talked about all of these ideas in one form or another, even negative interest. In my book, I have some citations of quote, real economists. But when this, when we transform money in this way, all of our intuitions about money and our natural repulsion toward the money realm are turned on their heads.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to. Another thing I want to say too is I talked about the abundance of the planet that's even today still there in the agricultural productivity and stuff and. So I've talked about the abundance of the planet and the possibility of different kinds of money systems. And all of these things don't require any huge effort to achieve, but they're already there, like right in front of our face.
Mm-hmm.
They're just a shift of perception away. It wouldn't really take that much for everybody to have a garden. And then there's no food crisis if we replace half of our lawn grass with intensive gardening.
Well,
and it's not even a sacrifice, really. That would improve people's lives.
From the Wilderness, one of the probably the scariest and most profound articles we ever published was called Eating Fossil Fuels by Dale Allen Pfeiffer back in 2002 or 2003. And what we clearly documented, what Dale clearly documented in that academically footnoted piece, you can find it at From the Wilderness, called Eating Fossil Fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Is that most of the soil from which our food is grown currently is little more than a sponge on which we pour chemicals.
Yeah.
Meaning that we can't just take soil that's been bastardized by Monsanto or Dow or whoever and start growing organic food the next day, there's a long period of soil restoration that has to occur.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of healing has to happen on our land.
Yeah, and so it's carrying 7 billion people while that healing takes place that is still the, if you will, the tactical issue for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think for a transitional period, it's not like we're going to run out of oil all of a sudden.
No.
But we're going to have to prioritize its use. But, you know, even given the current situation, you know, of the degradation of the soil, if we turned our efforts and our imagination and our creativity toward restoring the soil, I think that we would witness miracles of healing.
I think Mother Earth would probably rush out to help us if she sensed that change in our consciousness. We would meet that halfway.
And there's so many technologies that are kind of, you know, a lot of the doom and gloom scenarios are they're very well documented, well argued, but they buy into our current perception of what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But our perception of what's possible is determined in large part by the very same deep, invisible ideologies upon which our present civilization is built.
Yes.
You know, separation, the idea that you only change reality through the application of force because you're this separate being in an objective universe of force and mass and so forth. But I've certainly witnessed and become privy to things that are not considered possible from within that, you know, legitimate, respectable scientific worldview. My brother's a farmer, and he was reading about this biodynamic farm in Germany, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the farmer sent the soil and climatic data to the University of Stuttgart or something like that, to the agronomy department. And they responded in 6 weeks with, this land is not suitable for agriculture.
Right.
And next to that was photographs of this incredibly bountiful harvest, you know, tomato vines groaning with tomatoes, and you know, but the Department of Agronomy isn't going to accept that if you bury a cow horn full of quartz crystal dust or whatever other things the biodynamic farmers do, that it's going to improve the growth of your plants.
Well, but boy, does that stuff work. I mean, you know, we're doing permaculture here, and Danny, who is just went through the permaculture design school at Occidental Arts and Ecology, you know, she's coming back with all that stuff, and we're seeing how all that stuff does work.
Yeah,
and so what we're seeing, I think, is more the failure of Cartesian tyranny than anything else to give us a good explanation.
And that's the revolution that's happening right now. You know, the Cartesian worldview is, scientifically speaking, it's 100 years obsolete already.
Mm-hmm.
But our reason is still based on the logic of Descartes.
Exactly.
And from the logic, which says that, you know, what are you? You are a mote of consciousness inside a flesh robot in an objective universe of force and mass. And as our consciousness expands to understand our unity with all things, then so much more is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many technologies that have been ignored or suppressed simply because they don't conform to that Cartesian worldview. Healing technologies. I mean, there's 20 or 30 really powerful cures for cancer out there,
mm-hmm,
that have been suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, these free energy devices, which I probably shouldn't talk about because then everyone will think I'm a kook. But, you know, you look into those and there's this sordid history of suppression and, mm-hmm, and assassination, you know, going back to Nikola Tesla.
The only problem I have with that is making people see that you can't plug those into a billion internal combustion-powered vehicles that'll only run on oil. That's something that you have to get people to get first, you know.
Yeah, but still, you know, there's all these technologies, healing technologies,
yes,
for human beings, for the soil, for the land. You know, there's Paul Stamets, you know, who does micro-remediation.
He's amazing.
And yeah, like, why isn't he... You know, why isn't that being adopted nationwide? That's a shift of perception away. And so when the world based on the Cartesian worldview, when those institutions stop working, and it's undeniable, I mean, they've already stopped working, but we can still pretend that they're going to start working again somehow. But when we stop pretending, then I think we will really enter an age of miracles.
I hope so. That's a great place to end it. We have run out of time again, Charles. I hope you're going to come back regularly. You're certainly welcome here anytime. There's so much to explore, but I'm a little more optimistic than I have been, and I'm beginning to see that that those of us who have labored so long on this field are beginning to watch things that we have so long hungered for take place. And Charles, you're a big part of that. Please, everybody who can hear my voice, get out, find your closest Occupy movement, go take them blankets, food, bread, water, ask them what they need, go out and get into that, and watch exactly what Charles and I have been talking about tonight, taking place live in front of you. So we have exclusive Occupy Wall Street interviews next on the Progressive Radio Network. I want to thank everybody. Charles Eisenstein, thank you for joining us again. Charles, where can everybody find you?
I guess ascentofhumanity.com.
Ascentofhumanity.com. That's where you can follow Charles. By all means, get his book, Sacred Economics. It'll change the way you view the world. And we will be back to view it again next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Good night, everybody.
Thanks.